This is an interview with Betty Roberts. This is tape 3, side B.
So I carried on a campaign, and I knew a lot of teachers in the Lynch District through OEA and through my children being in the schools, and I got flyer material out to them, who they said they would get it out, and to the Centennial teachers who I had become acquainted with, and we just had a sort of a little mini campaign, but the other guys weren't doing anything. They just, you know, put their names on the ballot. And of course I beat the other guy, beat him quite handily, I think. And there certainly was never any question raised about the fact that I was divorced. So I became a school board member, and this other person became a school board member, which meant then that we had Kenny Landgraver and two others who were still just going along. But there was one of those who was up the following year, and so then another person from our group got on there. So we really had a good three people working. But some of the things that happened even after we got on the board were just appalling. At one point, Kenny Landgraver submitted a formal resolution to the board that teachers require the students to say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning before school started. And then I started law school. And as I started law school fall of 62. And I early on had constitutional law course and so on. I don't know exactly the date that this flag salute business came up, but it had to be probably 63 or so. He proposed it, and that night I had laryngitis. I said, we cannot vote on this tonight because I have to speak on it, and I am very adamantly opposed to it. It is unconstitutional. And then, of course, Kenny rants and raves, you know, the Supreme Court can't tell us what to do, what's constitutional, what's not, you know. So decided to set it for a month at the next monthly meeting. And I thought, well, that's great, you know, we'll have time to muster our forces. But so did they. And it was such a large crowd, they moved the board meeting into the auditorium, gymnasium, multipurpose room. And people showed up in their army uniforms, you know, waving the flag, doing all this sort of thing, Bibles in their hands. And here we five were. So our strategy was that I would propose a substitute resolution, which I did. And that was commending the teachers for their efforts in teaching patriotism, and that we encourage them to continue to do so, and that they should have regular scheduled programs, you know, for the whole school and so on. Something to say, you know, just teachers, be aware of this, and, you know, and when you can, teach some patriotism, which was, you know, was not what they wanted. And so I made my proposal, and everybody spoke on it. And so, you know, the ones who favored it would speak rationally, and those who were opposed to it would speak emotionally and threateningly. And in fact, at one point, some members said, we've got to get the communist teacher off the school board.
Which was me. Mm-hmm.
And accusing, you know, me of not being patriotic and being a communist and so on. So we took a vote. These other two men had promised me they would vote for it. We took the vote, and it was 4-1 against.
Oh, no. Gee. And you must have felt betrayed.
Oh, I did. I did. I was devastated. But, you know, it was amazing, the effect that had on me. I was not frightened, even though the accusations were going. I kept cool. Mm-hmm. I knew I was right. Mm-hmm. And I just said, these people just don't understand, mm-hmm. you know, what they're doing. But I think I know that this is an issue that the school board, you know, should not adopt. And of course, the teachers were with me. As it turned out, then, of course, Kenny's resolution was passed. But we were in the process of rewriting the whole policy for the school district. And somehow it just didn't get in, the new policy. But Kenny would do such things. I remember one incident when the teachers came and brought their proposed pay package. And he said, you know, we hire a lot of teachers who are women, and I think I'd be in favor of giving some of our men raises because they have families to support. But I don't think we should give raises to the women. And I couldn't miss the opportunity. I turned to him and I said, in the record, Kenny, I can't believe you said it. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And he said, I didn't say that. I said, it's what you said. And he stayed on for about another year. We finally, you know, got their courage up. And when he would rant and rave and tear at his tie and bring out the Bible and, you know, and carry on, we'd sort of sit and listen, and then we'd just vote against him. And the people who, you know, he could get stirred up gradually dwindled away. But of course, after that big meeting, the Gresham Outlook paper was there. They covered it all. Mm-hmm. You know, they covered the comments that were made, mm-hmm. and so on, and the fact that I opposed the flag salute in the schools got in the paper, which I was sure later on would be used in my campaigns when I ran for the legislature. Never was raised.
Never was raised.
I thought surely somebody would do it. The closest it ever came was when I ran for the Senate in 68, and I learned after the fact that some of Tom Mahoney's advisors said, why don't you use the flag salute? And he said, and give her all that publicity? Because that was when everybody thought, your name, you don't ever say your opponent's name.
Right.
Because that then is giving them some, giving the voters free information about who your opponent is. Mm-hmm. And that race was very close. But I always kept prepared. You know, I always said, okay, if that comes, I know what I'm going to say in a press release. But it never did.
What had you prepared?
Oh, just a statement of the facts, mm-hmm. that I had proposed an alternate resolution, and that was really the one that was defeated, and that the other one never went into effect.
You had mentioned a minute ago that the superintendent at the David Douglas School had he had been told that you were a troublemaker. What kinds of things were they referring to that led him to believe that this
I don't know,
been
just
true?
The fact that I was very active in Oregon Education Association, and this was when mm-hmm. OEA was just really beginning to feel some muscle. Mm-hmm. It certainly was not the big influential organization that it is today, mm-hmm. but teachers were getting organized. Usually the people on the boards were businessmen, quote, management, in their own mm-hmm. real life work. And so the fact that I was active there, the fact that I had run for the legislature, you know, and women teachers particularly, teachers are supposed to be docile anyway, you know, but women teachers are supposed to not do those sorts of things.
Right.
So I think it was just a question that I was active, you know, I was moving.
And the OEA was looked upon as being a troublemaking organization.
Well, they were pushing for these salary schedules. They mm-hmm. were pushing for increased sick leave. They were doing all these kinds of things that were a benefit mm-hmm. to teachers. Mm-hmm. And if I'm a teacher and I'm active with the OEA, in fact, I was elected from Easton, Multnomah County, to be the representative on what was then called the rep council that made these policy decisions. Mm-hmm. So I was in on the policy-making body that did this, and I think it was not. It was just the times that, and it was me as a woman who was being very active in all of this that they just thought it couldn't lead to any good. But I certainly was not doing anything other than just what certainly would not be considered unusual today.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that, well, is there anything else in terms of your teaching that you'd like to discuss?
Well, I went to David Douglas and taught there until I then went out to Mount Hood Community College later. I think the thing that we might want to talk about right here during this period of 62 is the fact that Frank and I had been married for just barely over a year in early 62 when we both talked about running for office. And I had been thinking of running out in East Multnomah County. We had districts in Multnomah County then, and there were three to be elected from all of the East Multnomah County area.
I thought Multnomah County at that point was still all, everything was at large.
Only the Senate seats.
Oh.
Senate seats were at large.
Okay.
But House districts, there were five districts. There was West Side, and there was North, and there was South, and this one, East Central district, and then East County.
And there were three that were coming from East County.
And there were three coming from East County.
And they were running at large within East County.
Right. So everybody just filed. You didn't run against any particular person. Position numbering came later, which was a forerunner of single-member districts. You just ran in a pack, and the top three won. So I had been thinking of running because I'd gotten acquainted with the legislators. I'd become active in Democratic politics. I was a precinct committeeman. Frank had been chair. And maybe still was in 62 of the Multnomah County Central Committee. So after Frank and I married, then my political activities in the party and getting acquainted with people who were office holders was considerably accelerated. I knew that by being successful on the board, then that I would start looking at whether or not I wanted to do this. Frank decided and that he would run for the Senate. Frank had been serving as one reading clerk in the House of Representatives in, I think, 61. And then after he was defeated, he went back to the legislature in 63 as chief clerk in the House of Representatives. Mm. So he had been actually as a staff person at the legislature, and he decided that he wanted to run for the Senate. There was an open seat in the Senate. Well, a senator had decided not to run. Those senators ran in a pack too. And that Ted Halleck got into that race, and Halleck edged Frank out, so he didn't win, and I didn't win. I came in fourth with the three to be elected, which was very encouraging to me. Both of us running, we both wanted to do it, and neither one of us was going to say to the other one, "No, you can't." But trying to do two campaigns out of one household, even though Frank could cover East Multnomah County because they were his voters too, but his other voters were not my voters. And we learned early on that, I think both of us, the press sort of started calling us a husband and wife team. Maureen Dick Neuberger had been in the legislature, and they sort of saw us as maybe trying to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Frank didn't like that, and I didn't like it. You know, I'd already been elected to the school board on my own when I was single. And I just said, hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm doing this because I want to do it. And it's not because I'm not following this man because he wants to do it. But that was difficult to explain to people who had never heard of me until I became a candidate for the state legislature.
And then under the name of Roberts.
And then under the name of Roberts, yeah. And it's amazing that, you know, people didn't know that Frank and I were so recently married either. It was, you know, I had my children, he had his children, and it was kind of difficult to get that message through. I didn't care about the voters, but I wanted the press to know it. You know, I wanted the press to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're separate people. I have a life over here, and he's got a life over there. We just happened to get married, and at a crucial time when we were both interested in politics. But I give Frank a lot of credit for involving me in the kind of political activity that he was already in as far as the party was concerned. But I took to it very readily, and it soon became my involvement, and not because Frank was there. It was, really my involvement was separate from his involvement. So in 62, I had, I guess, quite a few defeats. I was defeated in the primary. I lost my job at Centennial. Mm-hmm. And that summer I was told by Bert Wingert that I couldn't work on a PhD. And so I said to myself, well, okay, so things don't work out. I guess I'll just keep right on teaching and we'll see what, happens. But through my political activities, I had learned about Northwestern Law School, Northwest College of Law, as a night school, because I encountered many people who were lawyers who had gone to Northwestern, and realized that the school was there and that it was available. And so when, very shortly after I got back from Eugene that summer, I went to down to the office, which was a horrid little place. Dirty. The office was on a second floor above the telephone company, and they had two people, the woman who did all the clerical work, and then one man, Jack Kennedy, who sort of ran the law school, and then Judge Gantenbein, who screened the students. He was sort of the dean, although we didn't call anybody that, but that was sort of the role he played. It was a privately owned college that had been in existence here since, I think, the 1920s. I began to be more respectful of the school when I realized that that so many lawyers had, that's the way they got their education.
Mm-hmm. There weren't very many other options for them, were there, other than down
go
at
to
the U of O?
Go to U of O, mm-hmm. Yeah, right, or Willamette. Willamette University has a law school, and they did then,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But in the urban area, that was all there was. And these were people who were working days and going to school nights. And many of them were my age, I discovered. Some a little bit younger, maybe. But they were people generally who had a family and full-time work, but they were going to go to night law school. And I also learned that a number of our local judges, had graduated from that school. So even though it was a pretty cruddy place to go to school, the classrooms, we had three classrooms on the third floor. One was for all the freshman classes, one was for all of the, it was four-year school. We went Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. One classroom was for the sophomores, and then there was one classroom where the juniors and seniors, both third and fourth year students, used that room together, because one year they would teach one set of courses, and the next year they'd teach the other set of courses. So you had to stay in that room for 2 years in order to get all of your courses.
Going back just one step here, when you had all these experiences in 1962 of defeat, this seems like it must have been a fairly big impact on you, but was it?
It wasn't really. No? It was an impact. So some doors have closed, mm-hmm. but not forever. And I was beginning to feel very sure of myself in terms of I can always be a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have a job, and I'm good at what I do, mm-hmm. and I love it. And so I can do these things, and they don't work out, mm-hmm. but I have something to fall back on. Mm-hmm. And so while I might have been disappointed when these things happened, and complain about them, and not think people were very smart by shutting me out of some of these things, I still had enough self-confidence that I just moved right on.
You didn't take it as a personal rejection that somehow you weren't qualified or capable or anything like that.
No.
You know, I read in an article, an interview with you, where when you were looking back on your career, you mentioned teaching as well as being a mother as being the most rewarding experiences, even in light of your judicial experience and legislative experience. What did the teaching experience really mean for you? I mean, it seems like it was a very formative.
Well, first of all, for me personally, it helped me grow a lot. I had to learn a lot about issues, but I was concerned about those issues, and I also had to learn the teaching techniques. But I realized that I was good at it because I would get teachers usually say that you never get thanked for it. You know, teachers never hear this coming back, and I never felt that. I felt I always got reaction from my students. That we would interact together a lot, you know, because we were discussing current issues, you know, and sometimes I had to be the referee between students who would take, you know, different positions on issues.
Right.
But my classes, my students always liked my courses. And when we'd study economics, we'd do a unit on labor, and I'd bring my Pete Seeger records, and we'd listen to Pete Seeger and talk about, you know, what he was saying about the labor movement, and I would get some movies, educational films that were about real live people, you know, and the sewing machine fire and back east in the late 80s, 1800s, when so many women died because the doors were locked, you know, when there were no safety standards or anything of that sort, and the long hours they were. Yeah, I tried to bring in some really unique visual and learning experience for the students, and I loved all the stuff that I was teaching about, and the students then would obviously were getting a lot out of it too, and they'd say so. So I felt that every day I went into class, you know, I had this great experience. It was just, you know, kind of, hey, I'm pretty darn good at this. I would get tired, you know, I hated grading papers and I hated making up exams, but, you know, that's a part of it.
Sure.
And when I'd get tired, I'd go home and I knew I was a good mother, you know, and I'd say, hey, I'm good at this. My kids are doing thriving great. They're doing well in school, you know, and we go up to the mountain skiing and we do, you know, a lot of these activities together. It, to me, was just, you know, a wonderful time in that period when all my children were home doing well. I was doing well, and so if somebody says I can't get a PhD, I just, you know, say, so what? Sort of, screw you, I'll do something else. I didn't think about it, closing opportunities forever. It was just move on, just do the next thing.
Maybe you could also tell me a little bit more about how your relationship evolved with Frank. Because it seems like that might be
I spoke earlier of having him as a speech teacher. I think I may have taken one other course from him in parliamentary procedure, and I knew that Frank was divorced because students like to talk about their professors, but I had no interest in Frank whatsoever, and he had no interest in me when I was a student. But after my divorce, and after I was elected to the school board, sometime that summer of in the 60s, he just simply called me and asked me if I'd like to go to a play, which was Fantastics. You know that one?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was being put on by a local group here.
You play forever in some places.
Yeah. And I said, sure. I hadn't seen anybody, and really hadn't anticipated, you know, seeing anybody, going out with another man was the last thing, with a man, was really not very much on my mind. I certainly didn't feel lonesome with all the kids around and all the things I was doing. But at any rate, I said, sure, I'd go. So we went to the play, and then later he called and asked me to do something else, and then I started. Then he'd start picking me up to go to the Democratic Precinct Committee meetings, mm-hmm. Central Committee meetings, and things of that sort. Or I would meet him there, and we'd, you know, go have something to eat afterwards or whatever. And finally, and then he started that summer, before the summer was over, started taking me and the kids down on his sailboat at the Columbia. He invited me to a cocktail party on his houseboat. He was living on a houseboat down there and had his sailboat there. And in fact, he was with some other woman, and it was just a social thing. Ben Padro was there, a bunch of people that I knew from Portland State, and so it was just a nice affair, but we just began to see more of each other, and then he started taking us down on the boat. My kids thought the sailboat was wonderful, particularly my oldest daughter, and my oldest daughter and Frank became very good friends. She was certainly at a stage where someone of his intellect was very interesting to her. Mm-hmm. Diane was a valedictorian of her class at Centennial. She got 1 B all through her whole high school years. Mm. And so she was a junior then, and Frank was this good man to talk to because her father had never had any interest in anything. And so through the sailboating and seeing him then in the other activities, he started talking about that he was going to have to get off his houseboat before winter set in, because it's not very pleasant down on the Columbia River, I guess, during wintertime. And then we really started seeing each other a lot in September, October, and I don't know whether when he was there so much at the house, I always felt very uncomfortable because of kids around. And I think back on that and think if times had been different in 1960, Frank probably would have moved in and we lived together for a while. And then we'd have said, hey, this isn't going to work. You know, and that would have been it. But right. By November, he had asked me to marry him and said that he had to move off the houseboat. You know, I had a nice house.
You think
out
that was
there.
The reason?
Yeah, I think it was part of the reason. Jokingly, of course. I said, well, he's certainly has political interests, mm-hmm. and was a nice man to have around. Maybe he'll be good for my kids. He will be he'll be someone who they can certainly talk issues with and encourage them to go on themselves and get more education.
Right.
And so we got married right after Thanksgiving in a judge's chambers down in the courthouse. Got our license. And didn't have a ring.
In 1961?
60.
60.
In the fall, November 60. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a ring, and at the time I said I don't want one, and didn't have one for another year or so. pretty casual marriage.
Uh-huh.
After we left the courthouse, we went out and got the children and met Ben Padro and his wife at Japanese Bush Garden and had dinner, and that was it.
No honeymoon.
No anything. That was it. But anyway, then in 61, Keith was staying during most of the session. Was staying in Salem because he was working down there as the reading clerk.
You mean Frank?
Who would I say?
You said Keith.
Oh,
yeah.
Strike that one.
Okay.
Frank was working in the legislature, and then I was working on my master's degree, so I was still taking some night classes. You know, and he sort of went his way, and I went my way. I was doing that, but summers were great. We did a lot of sailing, and in the summertime, and then in '62 we ran. Both of us decided to run.
He was running for the Senate, and you were running for the House.
I was running for the House, mm-hmm. And didn't win. And so I started law school in the fall of '62. So I was gone 3 nights a week. Frank was very busy with his politics. He was very busy with his teaching at Portland State. And then each time the legislature was in session, he was down there as a staff person. So again, in '63, he was down in Salem. And so our lives just sort of went on in our own directions. I mean, you know, he came home and we did things with the kids, not a lot, but together, other than sailing. And we had a pretty happy time for those few years. I think by 64, when I decided that I was going to run for the legislature again, Frank was very supportive. Said, "Well, you know, you'll do it right this time, and do it." I said, "Yes, I will."